Stephen shook his head. No, I kind of moved on from the soldier thing, not because I disapproved. You gotta understand, this was way, way before all that long hair stuff arrived up here. Nobody objected to the military. I wasn't afraid of it either. Back then, there was nothing to be afraid of. We were the U.S., right? We were gonna whip the ass off those slanty-eyed gooks, 6 months maximum. Nobody was worried about going, it just seemed old-fashioned. We all respected it, we all loved the stories, but it seemed like yesterday's thing, you know what I mean? I wanted to go into business. I wanted to build my dad's yard up into a big corporation. That seemed like the thing to do. To me, that seemed like more of an American thing than going into the military. Back then, it seemed just as patriotic.
So you beat the draft? Reacher asked.
Stephen nodded. Draft board called me, but I had college applications pending, and they skipped right over me. My dad was close to the board chairman, which didn't hurt any, I guess.
How did Victor react to that?
He was fine with it. There was no issue about it. I wasn't anti-war or anything. I supported Vietnam, same as anybody else. It was just a personal choice, yesterday's thing or tomorrow's thing. I wanted tomorrow's thing. Victor wanted the army. He kind of knew it was kind of, well, staid. Truth is, he was pretty much influenced by his old man. He was 4F in World War II. Mine was a foot soldier, went to the Pacific. Victor kind of felt his family hadn't done its bit, so he wanted to do it, like a duty. Sounds stuffy now, right? Duty? But we all thought like that back then. No comparison at all with the kids of today. We were all pretty serious and old-fashioned around here. Victor maybe slightly more than the rest of us. Very serious, very earnest. But not really a whole lot out of the ordinary.
Reacher was 3/4 through with the bags. He stopped and rested against the pickup door.
Was he smart? Smart enough, I guess, Stephen said. He did well in school without exactly setting the world on fire. We had a few kids here over the years gone to be lawyers or doctors or whatever. One of them went to NASA, a bit younger than Victor and me. Victor was smart enough, but he had to work to get his grades, as I recall.
Reacher started with the bags again. He had filled the farthest shelves first, which he was glad about because his forearms were starting to burn.
Was he ever in any kind of trouble?
Stephen looked impatient.
Trouble? You haven't been listening to me, mister. Victor was straight as an arrow. Back when the worst kid would look like a complete angel today.
6 bags to go. Reacher wiped his palms on his pants. What was he like when you last saw him, between the 2 tours?
Stephen paused to think about it. A little older, I guess. I'd grown up a year. It seemed like he'd grown up 5. But he was no different, same guy, still serious, still earnest. They gave him a parade when he came home because he had a medal. He was real embarrassed about it, said the medal was nothing, and then he went away again and he never came back.
How did you feel about that?
Stephen paused again. Pretty bad, I guess. This was a guy I'd known my whole life. I'd have preferred him to come back, of course, but I was real glad he didn't come back in a wheelchair or something like a lot of them did.
Reacher finished the work.
He butted the last bag into position on the shelf with the heel of his hand and leaned on the post opposite Stephen.
What about the mystery? About what happened to him?
Stephen shook his head and smiled sadly. There's no mystery. He was killed. This is about 2 old folks refusing to accept 3 unpleasant truths is all.
Which are?
Simple, Stephen said. Truth 1 is their boy died. Truth 2 is he died out there in some godforsaken, impenetrable jungle where nobody will ever find him. Truth 3 is the government got dishonest around that time and they stopped listing the MIAs as casualties so they could keep the numbers reasonable. There were what? Maybe 10 boys on Vic's chopper when it went down? That's 10 names they kept off the nightly news. It was a policy. And it's too late for them to admit to anything now.
That's your take?
Sure is, Stephen said. The war went bad and the government went bad with it. Hard enough for my generation to accept, let me tell you. You younger guys are probably more at home with it. But you better believe the old folk like the Hobies are never going to square up to it.
He lapsed into silence and glanced absently back and forth between the empty pickup and the full shelves.
That's a ton of cement you shifted. You want to come in and wash up and let me buy you a soda?
I need to eat. Reacher said. I missed lunch.
Stephen nodded, and then he smiled, ruefully. Head south. There's a diner right after the train station. That's where we used to drink milkshakes. 9:30, Saturday night. Thinking we were practically Frank Sinatra.
The diner had obviously changed many times since daring boys with baseball cards and the wheels of their bicycles had sipped milkshakes there on Saturday nights. Now it was a 70s-style eatery, low and square, a brick facade, green roof, with a 90s-style gloss in the form of elaborate neon signs in every window, hot pinks and blues. Reacher took the leather-bound folder with him and pulled the door and stepped into chilly air smelling of Freon and burgers and the strong stuff they squirt on the tables before wiping them down. He sat at the counter and a cheerful, heavy girl of 20-something boxed him in with flatware and a napkin and handed him a menu card the size of a billboard with photographs of the food positioned next to the written descriptions. He ordered a half-pounder, Swiss, rare, slaw and onion rings, and made a substantial wager with himself that it wouldn't resemble the photograph in any way at all. Then he drank his ice water and got a refill before opening the folder. He concentrated on Victor's letters to his folks. There were 27 of them in total, 13 from his training postings and 14 from Vietnam. They bore out everything he'd heard from Ed Steven. Accurate grammar, accurate spelling, plain, terse phrasing. The same handwriting used by everybody educated in America between the 20s and the 60s, but with a backward slant. A left-handed person. None of the 27 letters ran more than a few lines over the page. A dutiful person. A person who knew it was considered impolite to end a personal letter on the first page. A polite, dutiful, left-handed, dull, conventional, normal person. Solidly educated, but no kind of a rocket scientist. The girl brought him the burger. It was adequate in itself, but very different from the gigantic feast depicted in the photograph on the menu. The slaw was floating in whitened vinegar in a crimped paper cup, and the onion rings were bloated in uniform like small brown automobile tires. The Swiss was sliced so thin it was transparent, but it tasted like cheese. The photograph taken after the passing out parade down at Rucker was harder to interpret. The focus was off, and the peak of his cap put Victor's eyes into deep shadow. His shoulders were back and his body was tense, bursting with pride or embarrassed by his mother. It was hard to tell. In the end, Reacher voted for pride because of the mouth. It was a tight line slightly down at the edges, the sort of mouth that needs firm control from the facial muscles to stop a huge, joyful grin. This was a photograph of a guy at the absolute peak of his life so far. Every goal attained, every dream realized. 2 weeks later, he was overseas. Reacher shuffled through the letters for the note from Mobile. It was written from a bunk before sailing. Mailed by a company clerk in Alabama. Sober phrases, a page and a quarter. Emotions tightly checked. It communicated nothing at all. He paid the check and left the girl a $2 tip for being so cheerful. Would she have written home a page and a quarter of tight-ass nothingness the day she was sailing off to war? No. But she would never sail off to war. Victor's helicopter went down maybe 7 years before she was born, and Vietnam was just something she had suffered through in 11th grade history class. It was way too early to head straight back to Wall Street. Jody had said 7 o'clock. At least 2 hours to kill, minimum. He slid into the Taurus and put the air on high to blow the heat away. Then he flattened the Hertz map on the stiff leather of the folder and traced a route away from Brighton. He could take Route 9 south to the Bear Mountain Parkway, the Bear east to the Taconic south to the Sprain, and the Sprain would dump him out on the Bronx River Parkway. That road would take him straight down to the Botanical Gardens, which was a place he had never been, and a place he was pretty keen to visit. Marilyn got to her lunch a little after 3 o'clock. She had checked the cleaning crew's work before she let them leave, and they had done a perfect job. They had used a steam cleaner on the hall rug, not because it was dirty, but because it was the best way of raising up the dents in the pile left by the credenza's feet. The steam swelled the wool fibers, and after a thorough vacuuming, nobody was ever going to know a heavy piece of furniture had once rested there. She took a long shower and wiped out the stall with a kitchen towel to leave the tiling dry and shiny. She combed her hair and left it to air dry. She knew the June humidity would put a slight curl in it. Then she got dressed, which involved one garment only. She put on Chester's favorite thing, a dark pink silk sheath, which worked best with nothing on underneath. It came just above the knee, and although it wasn't exactly tight, it clung in all the right places, as if it had been made for her, which in fact it had been, although Chester wasn't aware of that. He thought it was just a lucky off-the-peg accident. She was happy to let him think that, not because of the money, but because it felt a little, well, brazen to admit to having such a sexy thing custom made. And the effect on him was, frankly, brazen. It was like a trigger. She used it when she thought he needed rewarding, or deflecting. And he was going to need deflecting tonight. He was going to arrive home and find his house up for sale and his wife in charge. Any old way she looked at it, it was going to be a difficult evening. And she was prepared to use any advantage she could to get through it, brazen or not. She chose the Gucci heels, which matched the she's color, and made her legs look long. Then she went down to the kitchen and ate her lunch, which was an apple and a square of reduced-fat cheese, and then she went back upstairs and brushed her teeth again and thought about makeup. Being naked under the dress, and with her hair down in a natural style, the way to go was really no makeup at all. But she was prepared to admit she was just a little way past being able to get away with that. So she set out on the long haul of making herself up so she would look like she hadn't troubled to. It took her 20 minutes, and then she did her nails. Toes, too, because she felt that counted when it was likely her shoes would be coming off early. Then she dabbed her favorite perfume on, enough to be noticed without being overwhelming. Then the phone rang. It was Cheryl.
"Marilyn," she said. 6 hours on the market and you've got a nibble."
"I have, but who and how?"
"I know, the very first day before you're even listed anywhere. Isn't it wonderful? It's a gentleman who's relocating with his family, and he was cruising the area getting a feel for it, and he saw your sign. He came straight over here for the particulars. Are you ready? Can I bring him right over?"
"Wow, right now? Already? This is quick, isn't it? But yes, I guess I'm ready. Who is it, Cheryl? You think he's a serious buyer?"
"Definitely I do, and he's only here today. He has to go back west tonight."
"Okay, well, bring him on over, I guess. I'll be ready." She realized she must have been rehearsing the whole routine unconsciously without really being aware of it. She moved fast, but she wasn't flustered. She hung up the phone and ran straight down to the kitchen and switched the oven on low. Spooned a heap of coffee beans onto a saucer and placed them on the middle shelf. Shut the oven door and turned to the sink. Dropped the apple core into the waste disposal and stacked the plate in the dishwasher. Wiped the sink down with a paper towel and stood back, hands on hips, scanning the room. She walked to the window and angled the blind until the light caught the shine on the floor. "Perfect," she said to herself. She ran back up the stairs and started at the top of the house. She ducked into every room, scanning, checking, adjusting flowers, angling blinds, plumping pillows. She turned lamps on everywhere. She had read that to turn them on after the buyer was already in the room was a clear message the house was gloomy. Better to have them on from the outset, which was a clear message of cheerful welcome. She ran back down the stairs. In the family room, she opened the blind all the way to show off the pool. In the den, she turned on the reading lamps and tilted the blind almost closed to give a dark, comfortable look. Then she ducked into the living room. Shit. Chester's side table was still there, right next to where his armchair had been. How could she have missed that? She grabbed it two-handed and ran with it to the basement stairs. She heard Cheryl's car on the gravel. She opened the basement door and ran down and dumped the table and ran back up. Closed the door on it and ducked into the powder room. Straightened the guest towel and dabbed at her hair and checked herself in the mirror. God! She was wearing her silk sheath, with nothing underneath. The silk was clinging to her skin. What the hell was this poor guy going to think? The doorbell rang. She was frozen. Did she have time to change? Of course not. They were at the door right now, ringing the bell. A jacket or something? The doorbell rang again. She took a breath and shook her hips to loosen the fabric and walked down the hall. Took another breath and opened the door. Cheryl beamed in at her, but Marilyn was already looking at the buyer. He was a tallish man, maybe 50 or 55, gray, in a dark suit, standing side on, looking out and back at the plantings along the driveway. She glanced down at his shoes, because Chester always said wealth and breeding shows up on the feet. These looked pretty good. Heavy Oxfords, polished to a shine. She started a smile. Was this going to be it? Sold within 6 hours? That would be a hell of a thing. She smiled a quick conspirator smile with Cheryl and turned to the man.
Come in,
she said brightly, and held out her hand. He turned back from the garden to face her. He stared straight at her, frankly and blatantly. She felt naked under his gaze. She practically was naked. But she found herself staring right back at him because he was terribly burned. One side of his head was just a mass of shiny pink scars. She kept her polite smile frozen in place and kept her hand extended toward him. He paused, brought his hand up to meet it, but it wasn't a hand. It was a shining metal hook. Not an artificial hand, not a clever prosthetic device, just a wicked metal curve made of gleaming steel. Reacher was at the curb outside the 60-story building on Wall Street 10 minutes before 7 o'clock. He kept the motor running and scanned a triangle that had its point on the building's exit door and spread sideways across the plaza past the distance where somebody could get to her before he could. There was nobody inside the triangle who worried him. Nobody static, nobody watching. Just a thin stream of office workers jostling out to the street, jackets over their arms, bulky briefcases in their hands. Most of them were making a left on the sidewalk heading for the subway. Some of them were threading through the cars at the curb looking for cabs out in the traffic stream. The other cars parked were harmless. There was a UPS truck 2 places ahead, and a couple of livery vehicles with drivers standing next to them scanning for their passengers. Innocent bustle at the weary end of a busy day. Reacher settled back in his seat to wait, his eyes flicking left and right, ahead and behind, always returning to the revolving door. She came out before 7, which was sooner than he expected. He saw her through the glass in the lobby. He saw her hair and her dress, and the flash of her legs as she skipped sideways to the exit. He wondered for a second if she had just been waiting up on her high floor. The timing was plausible. She could have seen the car from her window gone straight to the elevator. She pushed the door and spilled out onto the plaza. He got out of the car and moved around the hood to the sidewalk and stood waiting. She was carrying the pilot's case. She skipped through a shaft of sun and her hair lit up like a halo. 10 yards from him, she smiled.
Hello, Reacher, she called.
Hello, Jody, he said. She knew something. He could see it in her face. She had big news for him, but she was smiling like she was going to tease him with it. What? He asked. She smiled again and shook her head.
You first, okay?
They sat in the car and he ran through everything the old couple had told him. Her smile faded and she turned somber. Then he gave her the leather-bound folder and left her to scan through it while he fought the traffic in a narrow counterclockwise square that left them facing south on Broadway, 2 blocks from her place. He pulled in at the curb outside an espresso bar. She was reading the reconnaissance report from Rudder and studying the photograph of the emaciated gray man and the Asian soldier.
Incredible,
she said quietly. Give me your keys, he said back. Get a coffee, and I'll walk up for you when I know your building's okay. She made no objection. The photograph had shaken her up. She just went into her bag for her keys and got out of the car and skipped straight across the sidewalk and into the coffee shop. He watched her inside and then eased south down the street. He turned directly into her garage. It was a different car, and he figured if anybody was waiting down there, they would hesitate long enough to give him all the advantage he would need. But the garage was quiet. Just the same group of parked vehicles looking like they hadn't moved all day. He put the Taurus in her slot and went up the metal stairs to the lobby. Nobody there. Nobody in the elevator. Nobody in the 4th-floor hallway. Her door was undamaged. He opened it up and stepped inside. Quiet, still air. Nobody there. He used the fire stairs to get back to the lobby and went out the glass doors to the street. Walked the 2 blocks north and ducked into the coffee shop and found her alone at a chrome table reading Victor Hobie's letters, an espresso untouched at her elbow. "You gonna drink that?" he asked. She stacked the jungle photograph on top of the letters.
"This has big implications," she said.
He took that for a no and pulled the cup over and swallowed the coffee in one mouthful. It had cooled slightly and was wonderfully strong.
"Let's go," she said.
She let him carry her case and took his arm for the two-block walk. He gave back her keys at the street door, and they went in through the lobby together and up in the elevator in silence. She unlocked the apartment door and went inside ahead of him.
"So it's government people after us," she said.
He made no reply. Just shrugged off his new jacket and dropped it on the sofa under the Mondrian copy.
"Has to be," she said.
He walked to the windows and cracked the blinds. Shafts of daylight poured in, and the white room glowed.
"We're close to the secret of these camps," she said. "So the government is trying to silence us, CIA or somebody."
He walked through to the kitchen, pulled the refrigerator door, and took out a bottle of water.
"We're in serious danger," she said. "You don't seem very worried about it."
He shrugged and took a swallow of water. It was too cold. He preferred it room temperature. "Life's too short for worrying," he said.
"Dad was worrying. It was making his heart worse."
He nodded. "I know. I'm sorry."
"So why aren't you taking it seriously? Don't you believe it?"
"I believe it," he said. "I believe everything they told me."
"And the photograph proves it, right? The place obviously exists."
"I know it exists," he said. "I've been there." She stared at him.
"You've been there? When? How?"
"Not long ago," he said. "I got just about as close as this Rudder guy got."
"Christ, Reacher," she said. "So what are you going to do about it?"
"I'm going to buy a gun."
"No, we should go to the cops or the newspapers, maybe. The government can't do this."
"You wait for me here, okay?"
"Where are you going?"
"I'm going to buy a gun. Then I'll buy us some pizza. I'll bring it back."
"You can't buy a gun, not in New York City, for God's sake. There are laws. You need ID and permits and things, and you've got to wait 5 days anyway."
"I can buy a gun anywhere," he said. "Especially New York City. What do you want on the pizza?"
"Have you got enough money?"
"For the pizza?"
"For the gun," she said.
"The gun will cost me less than the pizza," he said. "Lock the door behind me, okay? And don't open it unless you see it's me in the spy hole." He left her standing in the center of the kitchen. He used the fire stairs to the lobby and stood in the bustle on the sidewalk long enough to get himself lined up with the geography. There was a pizza parlor on the block to the south. He ducked inside and ordered a large pie, half anchovies and capers, half hot pepperoni, to go in 30 minutes. Then he dodged traffic on Broadway and struck out east. He'd been in New York enough times to know what people say is true. Everything happens fast in New York. Things change fast. Fast in terms of chronology, and fast in terms of geography. One neighborhood shifts into another within a couple of blocks. Sometimes the front of a building is a middle-class paradise, and around the back, bums are sleeping in the alley. He knew a fast 10-minute walk was going to take him worlds away from Jody's expensive apartment block. He found what he was looking for in the shadows under the approach to the Brooklyn Bridge. There was a messy tangle of streets crouching there and a giant housing project sprawling to the north and east. Some ragged, cluttered stores and a basketball court with chains under the hoops instead of nets. The air was hot and damp and filled with fumes and noise. He turned a corner and stood leaning on the chain link with the basketball noises behind him, watching two worlds collide. There was a rapid traffic flow of vehicles driving and people walking fast, and an equal quantity of cars stopped and idling and people standing around in bunches. The moving cars tacked around the stopped ones, honking and swerving, and the walking people pushed and complained and dodged into the gutter to pass the knots of loiterers. Sometimes a car would stop short and a boy would dart forward to the driver's window. There would be a short conversation and money would change hands like a conjuring trick, and the boy would dart back to a doorway and disappear. He would reappear a moment later and hustle back to the car. The driver would glance left and right, and accept a small package and force back into the traffic in a burble of exhaust and a blast of horns. Then the boy would return to the sidewalk and wait. Sometimes the trade was on foot, but the system was always the same. The boys were the cutouts. They carried the money in and the packages out, and they were too young to go to trial. Reacher was watching them use three doorways in particular, spaced out along the block frontage. The center of the three was doing the busiest trade, about 2-1 in terms of commercial volume. It was the 11th building, counting up from the south corner. He pushed off the fence and turned east. There was a vacant lot ahead which gave him a glimpse of the river. The bridge soared over his head. He turned north and came up behind the buildings in a narrow alley. Scanned ahead as he walked and counted 11 fire escapes. Dropped his glance to ground level and saw a black sedan jammed into the narrow space outside the 11th rear entrance. There was a boy of maybe 19 sitting on the trunk lid with a mobile phone in his hand. The back door guard. One step up the promotion ladder from his baby brothers shuttling back and forward across the sidewalk. There was nobody else around. The boy was on his own. Reacher stepped into the alley. The way to do it is to walk fast and focus on something way beyond your target. Make the guy feel like he's got nothing to do with anything. Reacher made a show of checking his watch and glancing far ahead into the distance. He hustled along, almost running. At the last minute, he dropped his gaze to the car like he was suddenly dragged back into the present by the obstacle. The boy was watching him. Reacher dodged left, where he knew the angle of the car wouldn't let him through. He pulled up in exasperation and dodged right, turning with the pent-up fury of a hurrying man balked by a nuisance. He swung his left arm with the turn and hit the kid square in the side of the head. The kid toppled, and he hit him again, right-handed. Just a short-arm jab, relatively gentle. No reason to put him in the hospital. He'd let him fall off the trunk lid unaided to see how far away he'd put him. A conscious person will always break his fall. This kid didn't. He hit the alley floor with a dusty thump. Reacher rolled him over and checked his pockets. There was a gun in there, but it wasn't the sort of thing he was going to bear home in triumph. It was a Chinese 22. Some imitation of a Soviet imitation of something that was probably useless to start with. He pitched it out of reach under the car. He knew the back door of the tenement would be unlocked, because that's the point of a back door when you're doing a roaring trade about 150 yards south of Police Plaza. They come in the front. You need to be able to get out the back without fumbling for the key. He inched it open with his toe and stood gazing into the gloom. There was an inner door off the back hallway leading to the right, into a room with a light on inside. It was about 10 paces away. No point in waiting. They weren't about to take a dinner break. He walked ahead 10 paces and stopped at the door. The building stank of decay and sweat and urine. It was quiet. An abandoned building. He listened. There was a low voice inside the room, then an answer to it. 2 people, minimum. Swinging the door open and standing and taking stock of the scene inside is not the way to do it. The guy who pauses, even for a millisecond, is the guy who dies earlier than his classmates. Reacher's guess was the tenement was maybe 15 feet wide, of which 3 were represented by the hallway he was standing in. So he aimed to be the other 12 feet into the room before they even knew he was there. They would still be looking at the door, wondering who else was coming in after him. He took a breath and burst through the door like it wasn't there at all. It crashed back against the hinge, and he was across the room in 2 huge strides. Dim light, a single electric bulb, 2 men, packages on the table, money on the table, a handgun on the table. He hit the first guy a wide, swinging roundhouse blow square on the temple. The guy fell sideways, and Reacher drove through him with a knee in the gut on his way back to the second man, who was coming up out of his chair with his eyes wide and his mouth open in shock. Reacher aimed high and smacked him with a forearm smash exactly horizontal between his eyebrows and his hairline. Do it hard enough, and the guy goes down for an hour, but his skull stays in one piece. This was supposed to be a shopping trip, not an execution. He stood still and listened through the door. Nothing. The guy in the alley was sleeping, and the noise on the street was occupying the kids on the sidewalk. He glanced at the table and glanced away again, because the handgun lying there was a Colt detective special. a six-shot, 38 caliber revolver, in blued steel with black plastic grips. Stubby little two-inch barrel. No good at all. Nowhere near the sort of thing he was looking for. The short barrel was a drawback and the caliber was a disappointment. He remembered a Louisiana cop he'd met, a police captain for some small jurisdiction out in the bayou. The guy had come to the military police for firearms advice, and Reacher had been detailed to deal with him. The guy had all kinds of tales of woe about the 38 caliber revolvers his men were using. He said, "You just can't rely on them to put a guy down, not if he's coming at you all pumped up on angel dust." He told a story about a suicide. The guy needed 5 shots to the head with a 38 to put himself away. Reacher had been impressed by the guy's unhappy face, and he had decided then and there to stay away from 38s, which was a policy he was not about to change now. So he turned his back on the table and stood still and listened again. Nothing. He squatted next to the guy he'd hit in the head and started through his jacket. The busiest dealers make the most money, and the most money buys the best toys, which was why he was in this building and not in one of the slower rivals up or down the street. He found exactly what he wanted in the guy's left-hand inner pocket, something a whole lot better than a puny 38 Detective Special. It was a big black automatic, a Steyr GB, a handsome 9mm which had been a big favorite of his Special Forces friends through most of his career. He pulled it out and checked it over. The magazine had all 18 shells in it, and the chamber smelled like it had never been fired. He pulled the trigger and watched the mechanism move. Then he reassembled the gun and jammed it under his belt in the small of his back and smiled. Stayed down next to the unconscious guy and whispered, "I'll buy your Steyr for $1. Just shake your head if you've got a problem with that, okay?" Then he smiled again and stood up. Peeled a dollar bill off his roll and left it weighted down on the tabletop under the detective special. Stepped back to the hallway, all quiet. He made the 10 paces to the back and came out into the light. Checked left and right, up and down the alley, and stepped over to the parked sedan. Opened the driver's door and found the lever and popped the trunk. There was a black nylon sports bag in there, empty. A small cardboard box of 9mm reloads under a tangle of red and black jump leads. He put the ammunition in the bag and walked away with it. The pizza was waiting for him when he arrived back on Broadway. It was sudden. It happened without warning. As soon as they were inside and the door was closed, the man hit Cheryl, a vicious backhand blow to the face with whatever was inside his empty sleeve. Marilyn was frozen with shock. She saw the man twisting violently and the hook swinging through its glittering arc, and she heard the wet crunch as his arm hit Cheryl's face, and she clamped both hands over her mouth, as if it were somehow vitally important she didn't scream. She saw the man spinning back toward her and reaching up under his right armpit and coming out with a gun in his left hand. She saw Cheryl going over backward and sprawling on the rug right where it was still damp from the steam cleaning. She saw the gun arcing at her along the exact same radius he had used before, but in the reverse direction, coming straight at her. The gun was made of dark metal, gray, dewed with oil. It was dull, but it shone. It stopped level with her chest, and she stared down at its color, and all she could think was, "That's what they mean when they say gunmetal." "Step closer," the man said. She was paralyzed. Her hands were clamped to her face, and her eyes were open so wide she thought the skin on her face would tear. "Closer," the man said again. She stared down at Cheryl. She was struggling up on her elbows. Her eyes were crossed, and blood was running from her nose. Her top lip was swelling, and the blood was dripping off her chin. Her knees were up, and her skirt was rucked. She could see her pantyhose change from thin to thick at the top. Her breathing was ragged. Then her elbows gave way again and slid forward, and her knees splayed out. Her head hit the floor with a soft thump and rolled sideways. "Step closer," the man said. She stared at his face. It was rigid. The scars looked like hard plastic. One eye was hooded under an eyelid as thick and coarse as a thumb. The other was cold and unblinking. She stared at the gun. It was a foot away from her chest, not moving. The hand that held it was smooth. The nails were manicured. She stepped forward a quarter step.
Closer.
She slid her feet forward until the gun was touching the fabric of her dress. She felt the hardness and the coldness of the gray metal through the thin silk.
Closer.
She stared at him. His face was a foot away from hers. On the left, the skin was gray and lined. The good eye was webbed with lines. The right eye blinked. The eyelid was slow and heavy. It went down, then up deliberately, like a machine. She leaned forward an inch. The gun pressed into her breast.
Closer?
She moved her feet. He answered with matching pressure on the gun. The metal was pressing hard into the softness of her flesh. It was crushing her breast. The silk was yielding into a deep crater. It was pulling her nipple sideways. It was hurting her. The man raised his right arm, the hook. He held it up in front of her eyes. It was a plain steel curve, rubbed and polished until it shone. He rotated it slowly with an awkward movement of his forearm. She heard leather inside his sleeve. The tip of the hook was machined to a point. He rotated the tip away and laid the flat of the curve against her forehead. She flinched. It was cold. He scraped it down her forehead and traced the curve of her nose. In under her nose, he pressed it against her top lip, brought it down and in and pressed until her mouth opened. He tapped it gently against her teeth. It caught on her bottom lip because her lip was dry. He dragged her lip down with the steel until the soft, rubbery flesh pulled free. He traced over the curve of her chin, down under her chin to her throat, up again an inch and back, under the shelf of her jaw, until he was forcing her head up with the strength in his shoulder. He stared into her eyes.
"My name is Hobie," he said.
She was up on tiptoes, trying to take the weight off her throat. She was starting to gag. She couldn't remember taking a breath since he had opened the door.
"Did Chester mention me?"
Her head was tilting upward. She was staring at the ceiling. The gun was digging into her breast. It was no longer cold. The heat of her body had warmed it. She shook her head. A small, urgent motion balanced on the pressure of the hook.
"He didn't mention me?"
"No,"
she gasped.
"Why, should he have?"
"Is he a secretive man?"
She shook her head again. The same small, urgent motion, side to side, the skin of her throat snagging left and right against the metal.
"Did he tell you about his business problems?"
She blinked, shook her head again.
"So, he is a secretive man?"
"I guess,"
she gasped.
"But I knew anyway."
"Does he have a girlfriend?"
She blinked again, shook her head.
"How can you be sure?"
Hobie asked.
"If he's a secretive man."
"What do you want?"
she gasped.
"But I guess he doesn't need a girlfriend. You're a very beautiful woman."
She blinked again. She was up on her toes. The Gucci heels were off the ground.
"I just paid you a compliment,"
Hobie said.
"Oughtn't you say something in response, politely?"
He increased the pressure. The steel dug into the flesh of her throat. One foot came free of the ground.
"Thank you,"
she gasped. The hook eased down. Her eye line came back to the horizontal and her heels touched the rug. She realized she was breathing. She was panting. In and out. In and out.
"A very beautiful woman."
He dropped the hook away from her throat. It touched her waist. Traced down over the curve of her hip. Down over her thigh. He was staring at her face. The gun was jammed hard in her flesh. The hook turned and the flat face of the curve lifted off her thigh, leaving just the point behind. It traced downward. She felt it slide off the silk onto her bare leg. It was sharp. Not like a needle, like a pencil point. It stopped moving. It started back up. He was pressing with it gently. It wasn't cutting her, she knew that. But it was furrowing against the firmness of her skin. It moved up. It slid under the silk. She felt the metal on the skin of her thigh. It moved up. She could feel the silk of her dress bunching and gathering in the radius of the hook. The hook moved up. The back of the hem was sliding up the backs of her legs. Cheryl stirred on the floor. The hook stopped moving and Hobie's awful right eye swiveled slowly across and down.
"Put your hand in my pocket," he said.
She stared at him.
"Your left hand," he said. "My right pocket."
She had to move closer and reach over and down between his arms. Her face was close to his. He smelled of soap. She felt around to his pocket, darted her fingers inside and closed them over a small cylinder, slid it out. It was a used roll of duct tape, an inch in diameter, silver, maybe 5 yards remaining. Hobie stepped away from her.
"Tape Cheryl's wrists together," he said.
She wriggled her hips to make the hem of her dress fall down into place. He watched her do it and smiled. She glanced between the roll of silver tape and Cheryl down on the floor.
"Turn her over," he said.
The light from the window was catching the gun. She knelt next to Cheryl, pulled on one shoulder and pushed on the other until she flopped over on her front.
"Put her elbows together," he said.
She hesitated. He raised the gun a fraction, and then the hook, arms wide, a display of superior weaponry. She grimaced. Cheryl stirred again. Her blood had pooled on the rug. It was brown and sticky. Marilyn used both hands and forced her elbows together behind her back. Hobie looked down.
"Get them real close," he said.
She picked at the tape with her nail and got a length free. Wrapped it around and around Cheryl's forearms just below her elbows.
"Tight,"
he said,
"all the way up."
She wound the tape around and around, up above her elbows and down to her wrists. Cheryl was stirring and struggling.
"Okay, sit her up,"
Hobie said. She dragged her into a sitting position with her taped arms behind her. Her face was masked in blood. Her nose was swollen, going blue. Her lips were puffy.
"Put tape on her mouth,"
Hobie said. She used her teeth and bit off a 6-inch length. Cheryl was blinking and focusing. Marilyn shrugged unhappily at her, like a helpless apology, and stuck the tape over her mouth. It was thick tape, with tough reinforcing threads baked into the silver plastic coating. It was shiny, but not slippery because of the raised crisscross threads. She rubbed her fingers side to side across them to make it stick. Cheryl's nose started bubbling and her eyes opened wide in panic.
"God, she can't breathe,"
Marilyn gasped. She went to rip the tape off again, but Hobie kicked her hand away.
"You broke her nose,"
Marilyn said.
"She can't breathe."
The gun was pointing down at her head, held steady, 18 inches away.
"She's going to die,"
Marilyn said.
"That's for damn sure,"
Hobie said back. She stared up at him in horror. Blood was rasping and bubbling in Cheryl's fractured airways. Her eyes were staring in panic. Her chest was heaving. Hobie's eyes were on Marilyn's face.
"You want me to be nice?"
he asked. She nodded wildly.
"Are you going to be nice back?"
She stared at her friend. Her chest was convulsing, heaving for air that wasn't there. Her head was shaking from side to side. Hobie leaned down and turned the hook so the point was rasping across the tape on Cheryl's mouth as her head jerked back and forth. Then he jabbed hard and forced the point through the silver. Cheryl froze. Hobie moved his arm left and right, up and down, pulled the hook back out. There was a ragged hole left in the tape, with air whistling in and out. The tape sucked and blew against her lips as Cheryl gasped and panted.
I was nice, Hobie said. So now you owe me, okay?
Cheryl's breathing was sucking hard through the hole in the tape. She was concentrating on it. Her eyes were squinting down like she was confirming there was air in front of her to use. Marilyn was watching her, sitting back on her heels, cold with terror.
Help her to the car, Hobie said.
Chapter 10. Chester Stone was alone in the bathroom on the 88th floor. Tony had forced him to go in there. Not physically. He had just stood there and pointed silently. And Stone had scuttled across the carpet in his undershirt and shorts, with his dark socks and polished shoes on his feet. Then Tony had lowered his arm and stopped pointing, and told him to stay in there and close the door on him. There had been muffled sounds out in the office, and after a few minutes the two men must have left because Stone heard doors shutting and the nearby whine of the elevator. Then it had gone dark and silent. He sat on the bathroom floor with his back against the gray granite tiling, staring into the silence. The bathroom door was not locked, he knew that. There had been no fiddling or clicking when the door closed. He was cold. The floor was hard tile, and the chill was striking up through the thin cotton of his boxers. He started shivering. He was hungry and thirsty. He listened carefully. Nothing. He eased himself up off the floor and stepped to the sink. Turned the faucet and listened again over the trickle of water. Nothing. He bent his head and drank. His teeth touched the metal of the faucet, and he tasted the chlorine taste of city water. He held a mouthful unswallowed and let it soak into his dry tongue. Then he gulped it down and turned the faucet off. He waited an hour, a whole hour, sitting on the floor, staring at the unlocked door, listening to the silence. It was hurting where the guy had hit him, a hard ache where the fist had glanced off his ribs, bone against bone, solid, jarring. Then a soft, nauseated feeling in his gut where the blow had landed. He kept his eyes on the door, trying to tune out the pain. The building boomed and rumbled gently, like there were other people in the world, but they were far away. The elevators and the air conditioning and the rush of water in the pipes and the play of the breeze on the windows added and canceled to a low, comfortable whisper, just below the point of easy audibility. He thought he could hear elevator doors opening and closing, maybe 88 floors down, faint bass thumps shivering upward through the shafts. He was cold and cramped and hungry and hurting and scared. He stood up, bent with cramps and pain, and listened. Nothing. He slid his leather soles across the tile, stood with his hand on the doorknob, listened hard. Still nothing. He opened the door. The huge office was dim and silent, empty. He padded straight across the carpet and stopped near the door out to the reception area. Now he was nearer the elevator banks. He could hear the cars whining up and down inside the shaft. He listened at the door. Nothing. He opened the door. The reception area was dim and deserted. The oak gleamed pale, and there were random gleams coming off the brass accents. He could hear the motor running inside a refrigerator in the kitchen to his right. He could smell cold, stale coffee. The door out to the lobby was locked. It was a big, thick door, probably fire-resistant in line with severe city codes. It was faced in pale oak, and he could see the dull gleam of steel in the gap where it met the frame. He shook the handle, and it didn't move at all. He stood there for a long time, facing the door, peering out through the tiny, wired glass window 30 feet away from the elevator buttons and freedom. Then he turned back to the counter. It was chest high, viewed from the front. In back, there was a desktop level, and the chest-high barrier was made up of cubby holes with office stationery and folders stacked neatly inside. There was a telephone on the desktop part, in front of Tony's chair. The telephone was a complicated console, with a handset on the left and buttons on the right, under a small oblong window. The window was a gray LCD readout that read, off. He picked up the handset and heard nothing except the blood hissing in his ear. He pressed random buttons. Nothing. He quartered the console, tracing his finger left to right across every button, searching. He found a button marked Operate. He pressed it, and the little screen changed to Enter Code. He pressed random numbers, and the screen changed back to Off. There were cupboards under the desktop, little oak doors. They were all locked. He shook each of them in turn and heard little metal tongues striking metal plates. He walked back into Hobie's office, walked through the furniture to the desk. There was nothing on the sofas. His clothes were gone. Nothing on the desktop. The desk drawers were locked. It was a solid desk, expensive, ruined by the gouges from the hook, and the drawer locks felt tight. He squatted down, ridiculous in his underwear, and pulled at the handles. They moved a fraction, then stopped. He saw the trash can under the desk. It was a brass cylinder, not tall. He tilted it over. His wallet was in there, empty and forlorn. The picture of Marilyn was next to it, face down. The paper was printed over and over on the back. Kodak. He reached into the can and picked it up, turned it over. She smiled out at him. It was a casual head-and-shoulders shot. She was wearing the silk dress. The sexy one. The one she'd had custom made. She didn't know he knew she'd had it made. He had been home alone when the store called. He told him to call back and let her believe he thought it was off the rack. In the photo, she was wearing it for the first time. She was smiling shyly. Her eyes animated with daring, telling him not to go too low with the lens, not down to where the thin silk clung to her breasts. He cradled the picture in his palm and stared at it, and then he placed it back in the can because he had no pockets. He stood up urgently and stepped around the leather chair to the wall of windows, pushed the slats of the blinds apart with both hands and looked out. He had to do something. But he was 88 floors up. Nothing to see except the river in New Jersey. No neighbors, opposite to gesture urgently at. Nothing at all opposite, until the Appalachians reached Pennsylvania. He let the blinds fall back and paced every inch of the office, every inch of the reception area, and back into the office to do it all over again. Hopeless. He was in a prison. He stood in the center of the floor, shivering, focusing on nothing. He was hungry. He had no idea what time it was. The office had no clock, and he had no watch. The sun was getting low in the west, late afternoon or early evening, and he hadn't eaten lunch. He crept to the office door, listened again. Nothing except the comfortable hum of the building and the rattle of the refrigerator motor. He stepped out and crossed to the kitchen. He paused with his finger on the light switch, and then he dared to turn it on. A fluorescent tube kicked in. It flickered for a second and threw a flat glare across the room and added an angry buzz from its circuitry. The kitchen was small, with a token stainless steel sink and an equal length of counter. Rinsed mugs upside down, and a filter machine tarred with old coffee. A tiny refrigerator under the counter. There was milk in there and a six-pack of beer and a Zabar's bag neatly folded shut. He pulled it out. There was something wrapped in newspaper. It was heavy and solid. He stood up and unrolled the paper on the counter. There was a plastic bag inside. He gripped the bottom, and the severed hand thumped out on the counter. The fingers were white and curled, and there was spongy purple flesh and splintered white bone and empty blue tubes trailing at the wrist. Then the glare of the fluorescent light spun around and tilted past his gaze as he fainted to the floor. Reacher put the pizza box on the elevator floor and took the gun out of his belt and zipped it into the sports bag with the spare shells. Then he crouched and picked up the pizza again in time for the elevator door to slide back on the fourth floor. The apartment opened up as soon as he stepped within range of the fisheye in the door. Jody was standing just inside the hallway, waiting for him. She was still in the linen dress. It was slightly creased across the hips from sitting all day. Her long brown legs were scissored, one foot in front of the other. I brought dinner, he said. She looked at the sports bag instead.
Last chance, Reacher. We should talk with somebody about all of this.
No, he said. He put the bag on the floor and she stepped behind him to lock the door.
Okay, she said. If this is the government doing something, maybe you're right. Maybe we should stay away from the cops.
Right, he said.
So I'm with you on this.
Let's eat, he said. He walked through to the kitchen with the pizza. She had set the table. There were two place settings opposite each other. Plates, knives and forks, paper napkins, glasses of ice water. Like two people were resident in the apartment. He put the box on the counter and opened it up. You choose, he said. She was standing close behind him. He could feel her there. He could smell her perfume. He felt the flat of her hand touch his back. It burned. She left it there for a second. Then she used it to move him out of the way.
Let's split it, she said.
She balanced the box on her arm and carried it back to the table. Pulled the slices off each other while the box canted and wobbled. Shared them between the plates. He sat and sipped the water and watched her. She was slender and energetic and could make any mundane activity look like a graceful ballet. She turned away and dumped the greasy box and turned back. The dress twisted and flowed with her. She sat down. He heard the whisper of linen on skin, and her foot hit his knee under the table.
Sorry, she said.
She wiped her fingers on the napkin and tossed her hair behind her shoulders, and held her head at an angle for the first bite. She ate left-handed, rolling the wedge into a point, attacking it hungrily.
No lunch, she said. You told me not to leave the building.
She darted her tongue out and caught a thread of cheese, smiled self-consciously as she hooked it back between her lips. They shone with the oil. She took a long drink of water.
Anchovies, my favorite. How did you know?
But they make you thirsty later, don't they? So salty. Her dress was sleeveless, and he could see her arms all the way down from the little knob of bone at the top of the shoulder. They were slim and brown and narrow. Almost no muscle there at all, just tiny biceps like tendons. She was gorgeous, and she took his breath away. But she was a puzzle, physically. She was tall, but she was so tiny he didn't see how there was room for all the essential organs inside her. She was as thin as a stick, but looked vibrant and firm and strong. A puzzle. He remembered the feel of her arm around his waist 15 years before, like somebody was tightening a thick rope around his middle. I can't stay here tonight, he said. She looked across at him.
Why not? You got something to do, I'll come do it too. Like I said, I'm with you on this.
No, I just can't stay, he said.
Why not?
She asked again. He took a deep breath and held it. Her hair was shimmering in the light. It's not appropriate that I should stay here, he said.
But why not?
He shrugged, embarrassed. Just because, Jody. Because you're thinking of me like a brother or an uncle or something, because of Leon. But I'm not that, am I? She was staring at him. I'm sorry, he said. Her eyes were wide.
What?
This is not right, he said gently. You're not my sister or my niece. That's just an illusion because I was close to your dad. To me, you're a beautiful woman, and I can't be here alone with you.
Why not?
She asked again, breathless. Christ, Jody, why not? Because it's not appropriate, that's why not. You don't need to hear all the details. You're not my sister or my niece, and I can't keep on pretending you are. It's driving me crazy, pretending. She was very still, staring at him, still breathless.
How long have you felt this way?
She asked. He shrugged, embarrassed again. Always, I guess. Since I first met you. Give me a break, Jody. You weren't a kid. I was nearer your age than Leon's. She was silent. He held his breath, waiting for the tears, the outrage, the trauma. She was just staring at him. He was already regretting having spoken. He should have just kept his damn mouth shut. Bitten his damn lip and gotten through it. He had been through worse. although he couldn't exactly remember where or when. "I'm sorry," he said again. Her face was blank, wide blue eyes staring at him.